Welcome to Base by Base. Have you ever just stopped and marveled at the sheer coordination happening inside your body? Like, right now.
It's pretty staggering when you think about it.
Yeah, think about every single muscle fiber firing just perfectly when you reach for something, or your immune cells navigating through all this complex tissue to find one tiny invader.
It's like this incredibly complex molecular traffic control system. Billions, trillions of cells constantly getting signals, acting on them.
And that communication, that cell talk, it's absolutely fundamental.
It really is. And a super critical way cells talk, especially over distances, is through these secreted molecules called chemokines.
And they talk to specific receptors on the cell surface, right?
Exactly. Receptors that belong to this huge family called G-protein-coupled receptors, or GPCRs. They're basically the cell's main sensors for what's happening outside.
And the scale of the specific system, the chemokine GPCR one, it's just wild.
Yeah, it's the most abundant ligand receptor system in the whole GPCR family.
We're talking, what, 46 different chemokines in humans?
Interacting with 23 different receptors.
Right.
And that creates this network with, like, over 100 validated connections. It's huge.
A massive conversation happening all the time, directing traffic.
Absolutely. And it's essential for, well, everything from how we develop as embryos to directing immune cells, you know, where they need to go to fight infection or heal a cut.
But here's the thing that's always puzzled scientists, right? Despite this incredible complexity, like, some chemokines only talk to one receptor, very specific.
Really slow.
While others are, you know, promiscuous and chat with several.
Right.
The molecules themselves, their basic structures, they look surprisingly similar.
They do. It's a bit of a head scratcher.
So that's the core puzzle, isn't it? How do they manage that? This mix of super specific chats and more general announcements when they all kind of look alike.
Exactly. What are the molecular rules? How is that specificity and sometimes lack of it encoded?
That's what we're digging into today.
Yeah, there's this really fascinating paper came out recently in Cell, Kleist and colleagues, published in 2025.
Okay.
And they really tackled this head on. They stepped back, looked at the entire system using this data science approach, pulled together tons of sequence data, structural info, functional data.
Wow. Okay. So not just looking at one pair in isolation, but the whole network logic.
Precisely. It's a dense paper. For sure.
I bet.
But our mission here is to unpack it, right? Pull out the big surprises, the key insights for you.
Okay, let's do it. So where do we start? How do these things even physically interact, basically?
Well, the paper confirms the basic picture we've seen from existing structures, like they show in their figure 1G conceptually. It boils down to this fundamental mode, the chemokine molecule. It has a fairly rigid, folded core structure.
Okay.
While the receptor, right at the beginning part that sticks out of the cell, has this flexible, kind of floppy, unstructured bit. The N-terminus.
Floppy bit, rigid bit.
Yeah. And the main interaction is the receptor's floppy N-terminus contacting the chemokine's rigid core, and also the chemokine's own flexible N-terminus interacting with the receptor core. It's reciprocal.
Okay. A flexible piece hitting a rigid piece. That sounds like it could allow for some wiggle room, maybe.
It definitely does. Even with that basic setup, the exact way a specific chemokine docks onto its receptor, the orientation, it can vary quite a bit. So the paper proposes that the rules for this whole communication network aren't like a single rigid lock and key for every interaction.
Yeah.
Instead, it's more like a layered system.
Layers. Okay, like different levels of security clearance or something.
Kind of, yeah. Think of it like encryption keys. Layer one is about generalized recognition. These are the public keys.
Public keys, okay.
These are elements, specific amino acids. They're highly conserved across pretty much the whole chemokine and receptor families.
Yeah.
They likely help these molecules just recognize each other as a chemokine GPCR pair, you know, distinguishing them from all the other signals and sensors out there.
Right. So you'd expect the parts where they actually touch to be really, really conserved then, if it's for general recognition.
That's what you'd think, intuitively. But here's one of the first real surprises the paper highlights. If you look at their analysis, like in figures 2D and 2G,
yeah,
they found that only a tiny fraction, like just 3% of the total molecular contacts between a chemokine and receptor involve these residues that are highly conserved across both entire families.
Wait, only 3%? That seems really low for a general recognition layer.
It is pretty counterintuitive.
So if it's not like the whole contact surface is conserved, where are these few critical conserved spots?
So figure 2E shows they're often found clustered near these really important structural features called disulfide bonds. Both the chemokine and the receptor have them. They help hold the protein's 3D shape together.
Like structural stable.
Exactly. And the conserved contacts near them seem to act like fundamental anchor points, a stable base for the whole interaction.
So less like a perfectly matched mold and more like a few really strong shared anchor points.
Precisely. The paper uses a great analogy in Figure 2F. Think of Lego bricks. You have conserved knobs and holes, those few conserved contact points. They allow different Lego bricks, different chemokines and receptors, to connect. But crucially, different types of bricks can connect using the same knobs and holes, and the overall way they fit together can be flexible.
So the connection points are standard, but what connects can vary.
Exactly. This degeneracy, this flexibility using basic anchors, seems key to allowing all the variation in the system while still making sure they connect at all.
And do these few spots actually matter, like functionally?
Oh, absolutely. They reference work shown conceptually in Figure 2H, using the CXCR4 receptor as an example. If you mutate those conserved residues on the receptor, especially the ones near the disulfide bonds, chemokine binding drops off significantly. So even though there aren't many of them, they are absolutely essential. The basic handshake.
Okay, so layer one, essential handshake, few conserved anchors, allows for flexible connections. Got it. Well, what's layer two? How does it get more specific?
Layer two brings in subfamily-specific recognition. Now we're talking semi-private keys. You mentioned earlier, chemokines mostly fall into two big subfamilies, CC and CXC.
Right, based on that single amino acid, the X near the beginning.
That's the classic definition, yeah, shown in Figure 3A. And generally, CC chemokines bind CC receptors, CXC bind CXC receptors. That's the trend, shown in Figure 3B.
So it's all about that X.
Well, that's what you might think. But the paper found it's way more subtle than that. Using their big data approach, they identified many other positions scattered across the whole interaction surface that are highly predictive of whether a molecule is CC or CXC.
So it's not just one switch, it's like a distributed code.
Exactly. See Figure 3D and S4A for that idea. It's encoded in multiple places.
Okay, so how does this distributed subfamily code work with the general anchors from layer one?
Yeah, this is where it gets really neat. The paper shows how these subfamily predictive spots on, say, the chemokine often interact with those conserved layer one spots on the receptor or with other subfamily-specific spots. This creates distinct structural patterns, different ways of docking for CCCC pairs versus CXCXC pairs. See figures 3EF.
Can you give an example?
Sure. They point out a conserved cysteine residue in the receptor, says 1x22, using standard numbering. It gets contacted differently depending on whether a CC or CXC chemokine is binding.
Okay.
And they also found these key sensor positions inside the receptor's binding pocket. Positions like 1x24 and 6x58, again using that numbering, shown in Figure 3G. These act like feelers.
Feelers? How so?
They interact with different residues on the chemokine depending on whether it's a CC or CXC type. They're essentially reading that distributed subfamily code on the incoming chemokine.
Wow. So the receptor has built-in detectors for the subfamily type.
That's the idea. And they back this up experimentally too. Figure 3H shows results where they mutated these specific sensor residues in a typical CC receptor, CCR5, or a CXC1, CXCR4.
And what happened?
It drastically messed up their ability to respond to their own subfamily's ligands.
Yes.
Sometimes it even made them respond a bit to the wrong subfamily.
So it really confirmed these spots act like molecular switches for telling CC from CXC?
Exactly. Crucial switches for that level of recognition.
Okay, layer one general, layer two subfamily. But the real magic is how one specific chemokine picks out just one or two partners from its own subfamily, right? That extreme specificity.
That's layer three, network-specific recognition. These are the private keys. This requires real molecular customization, fine-tuning based on specific sequence and structural differences right at the interface. Figure 4A illustrates this need.
And what did the analysis show about this fine-tuning across the whole network?
They found a really clear pattern, which they show in Figure 4B. If you take two chemokines or two receptors that share a lot of binding partners, meaning they're more promiscuous, they tend to share more sequence and structural features at the interface. Makes sense, right? But if they're highly selective, don't share partners, they share fewer features at that interface.
So it really supports this idea of selectivity being built up layer by layer. You add more specific features on top. like in Figure 4C.
Precisely. And it's not just about adding features that help binding to the right partner.
Ah, you also need features to stop binding to the wrong ones.
Exactly. They talk about positive selectivity, things that promote binding to the right partner, and negative selectivity features that actively block binding to the wrong ones. Figure 4D explains this.
Okay. Examples.
For positive selectivity, they looked at CXCL8. It binds two related receptors, CXCR1 and CXCR2. And figures 4E and F show it uses a core set of pretty much identical amino acid contacts with both of them. Shared features for shared partners.
Makes sense. And negative selectivity. How do you build in a keep-out sign?
Figure 4G gives a potential example with CXCL12. It normally binds CXCR4. If it tried to bind the wrong receptor, say CXCR2, specific residues might clash, like physically bump into each other or have charges that repel.
Like a molecular bad fit.
Yeah, a built-in barrier to prevent that wrong interaction.
So where on the molecules are these super specific fine-tuning bits concentrated?
This is really interesting. The paper found they're significantly enriched in those flexible, unstructured regions we talked about at the start.
The floppy bits again.
Yep. Specifically, the N-termini of both the chemokines and the receptors, and also a flexible loop on the receptor called ECL2. Figures S5EG show this enrichment.
So the most specific information is in the most flexible parts. That still feels kind of weird.
It does, doesn't it? But the argument is that these unstructured regions contain, and I quote, densely packed selectivity hotspots. See figures 4FH.
Hotspots, meaning?
Meaning a short stretch of amino acids in these flexible regions can pack in a ton of critical information for deciding who to bind to and who to avoid. Maybe because their flexibility lets them twist and turn to fit just right with the partner, or bend away from a non-partner.
Okay, that leads us nicely into these SLIMs they talk about, short linear motifs. What are those exactly?
SLIMs, yeah. They're short functional sequences of amino acids, usually just like 3 to 10 residues long, and they're typically found buried within these longer, unstructured, floppy regions of proteins. Figure 5A gives a sense of this.
And that they do.
They're known to be crucial for mediating protein interactions in many systems, like little docking sites or recognition codes embedded in the flexible regions. But because they are in flexible regions, their exact shape and position can shift around, which makes them super hard to study with traditional methods like X-ray crystallography.
Right, hard to get a snapshot if it's always moving. So how did this paper find them?
They used some clever computational tools. Instead of trying to align these messy flexible sequences, which is hard, they used an alignment-free method, basically searching for short, recurring peptide patterns.
Okay.
Then they looked at how conserved these patterns were. Were they the same across different species? That suggests importance. How much did they vary within the human chemokine family? That suggests roles and specialization.
And what was the key takeaway about SLIMs and chemokines and their receptors?
A really big finding, hinted at in figures S6, C, and D, is that while some SLIMs are shared between a few related chemokines or receptors, the vast majority seem to be unique to just one molecule.
Unique, so they're like individual molecular fingerprints.
Pretty much. It strongly suggests these SLIMs are major drivers of the specific individual binding profiles. They also found SLIMs that are super conserved across different animals, implying they do something really important but vary a lot between different human family members. Paralogs, figure S6B.
Meaning they might evolve quite fast to create new specificities.
That's the idea. Rapid adaptation potential built into these flexible regions.
Okay, but did they prove these SLIMs actually do anything experimentally?
Yes, they did some really elegant experiments. They focused on a chemokine called CCL28. It naturally binds two different receptors, CCR3 and CCR10. Figures 5C, D set this up.
Okay.
What they did was create different versions of CTL28 by chopping off bits of its flexible N-terminus. This effectively exposed or altered different potential SLIMs within that region. Then they tested how well these chopped versions activated CCR3 versus CCR10.
What did they see?
A really striking result shown in Figure 5D. One particular chopped version called CCL28-LPI showed significantly better activity at the CCR3 receptor.
Better.
But its activity at the CCR10 receptor was severely reduced.
Whoa. So messing with one small bit had opposite effects on two different partners.
Exactly. That's the aha moment they highlight, shown conceptually in Figure S6G. It's beautiful proof that subtle changes, tiny variations within these SLIMs in the same flexible region, can act like differential switches, They can tune interactions up for one receptor and down for another.
It's like variations on a password that give you different access levels depending on the system you're logging into.
That's a great analogy. And it underlines how the flexibility and the rapid evolution potential of these slim regions are likely critical for fine-tuning selectivity in this system.
This is really getting into the weeds of molecular mechanics. How does this connect back to, you know, us, to human health and variation?
Great question. The paper bridges this gap by looking at genetic variations found in big human population databases. See figure 5e and the surrounding supplementals like S6H, I, J.
And what patterns did they see? Any link to disease?
Well, one interesting negative finding first. Variants that are specifically linked to driving cancer. They're actually pretty rare right at the chemokine GPCR interface itself. Figure S6H shows this.
Meaning changes in binding aren't a main way these things cause cancer.
Seems that way, yeah. But natural variations, the ones floating around in the general population, are much more common at the interface. Figure S6I. And here's the kicker. When they looked at variants linked to actual traits or diseases in huge studies like the UK Biobank, the variants at the interface were often associated with things like immune cell counts or inflammatory diseases. Figure S6J points this out.
Which makes perfect sense, right? Given their job in immunity.
Totally makes sense. It fits the biology perfectly.
Can you give us a really concrete example, a specific variant doing something?
Absolutely. They highlight a classic example involving the ACKR1 receptor. It's not a signaling receptor, more of a chemokine scavenger, but the principle applies. There's a common variant in its flexible N-terminus, where one amino acid glycine at position 42 is swapped for aspartic acid, Gly42-ASP. See figure 5EF.
Okay, Gly42 in ACKR1, what does it do?
This variant is famous because it's strongly linked to susceptibility to malaria caused by Plasmodium vivax. Figure 5F, S7A, shows the association.
Wow.
And the paper's analysis suggests that Ty41 and this Gly42 position likely work together as a functional slim within that flexible N-terminus. Figures 5I, S7BC propose this.
So a single amino acid change in a flexible slim affects malaria risk. How?
Yeah. Their experiments show that the ASP variant subtly but significantly decreases how well ACKR1 binds to several different chemokines compared to the original Gly variant. See figure 5GH.
Oh, so it changes the interaction profile.
Just enough. It's a fantastic real-world example of how a tiny tweak in a slim, in a flexible region, leads to a measurable functional change and ultimately a difference in disease susceptibility. A phenotypic trade-off illustrated in figure 5I.
Amazing how these tiny molecular details scale up. Okay, this foundational science is incredible, but you know, the ultimate test of understanding something
is being able to build it or change it.
Exactly. Did they try to engineer chemokine selectivity based on all these rules they uncovered?
They did, and this part is super exciting, I think. They took on a challenge using a viral chemokine called VMIP2.
A viral chemokine?
Yeah, secreted by a type of herpes virus.
Mm-hmm.
And this VMIP2 is really promiscuous. Structurally, it looks like a CC chemokine, but it can bind receptors from both the CC and the CXC subfamilies. Figure 6A introduces it.
Why would a virus make something like that?
Ah, viruses are clever. By hitting receptors in multiple families, VMIP can probably interfere with a whole range of the host's immune responses, helping the virus hide or spread. It's molecular sabotage.
Okay, so they use this promiscuous viral molecule as a testbed.
Exactly. Can we use our rules to re-engineer it, make it less promiscuous, more specific?
How they approach that?
First, they analyzed how VMIP2 managed to bind the CXC receptor, CXCR4, even though it's a CC type. They found it used specific residues that kind of mimicked features normally found in human CXC chemokines. See figure 6B.
So it was using CXC-like keys, even though it was a CC lock?
Sort of, yeah. So their strategy, shown in figure 6D and supplementals S7GH, was to design specific mutations in VMIP2. They tried to swap those CXC-like residues for more typical CC-like ones based on a human CC chemokine called CCL8. They also tried introducing negative selectivity features, those molecular barriers designed to block binding to the CXC receptor.
Basically rewriting its access codes.
That's the goal.
And did it work?
It worked beautifully. The results in figure 6E and S7IL show the engineered VMIP2 mutants had significantly reduced ability to activate the CXC receptor, CXCR4, while they maintained or even slightly increased their ability to activate several human CC receptors, like CCR3 and CCR5.
Wow, so they successfully steered its binding away from the CXC family while keeping its CC activity.
Yes, It's a really powerful demonstration that the principles they uncovered, the layered encoding, the role of specific residues in SLIMS, aren't just descriptive. You can actually use them to rationally redesign these interactions.
That's fantastic. So let's try and synthesize this. It really is a layered system, isn't it?
Absolutely. Selectivity is encoded hierarchically. You've got the basic conserved anchors for general recognition, layer one.
Yeah.
Then the subfamily sensors distinguishing CC and CXC, layer two. And finally, the really fine-grained tuning comes from those specific, often rapidly evolving SLIMs, mostly in the flexible regions, layer three.
Back to the encryption idea, public keys for everyone, semi-private for the group, and then these really complex, unique, flexible private keys, the SLIMs, for one-on-one secure communication.
That's a perfect summary. Figure 7A captures that idea. And the flexibility, especially in those SLIM regions, gives the whole system the ability to adapt and evolve new connections relatively quickly.
This knowledge feels incredibly powerful. Where does this lead? What are the future applications?
Oh, the potential is huge, especially, I think, for designing smarter therapeutics, like in Figure 7BC. Imagine engineering therapeutic cells, maybe TORAR T cells fighting cancer.
Yeah.
Imagine modifying their chemokine receptors so they only respond to the specific chemokine address labels found uniquely in the tumor environment or in inflamed tissue.
So you could program them to go exactly where needed and nowhere else, like a molecular GPS?
Exactly. Unprecedented control over programming cell migration.
Mm.
Of course, the paper acknowledges limitations.
Right.
They didn't look at everything.
Mm.
There are other molecules involved, like complex sugars called GAGs, or how receptors might cluster together. And getting super high-risk pictures of those floppy SLIMs is still tough.
Sure, it's complex biology.
But this provides a really solid framework, a way to think about and maybe manipulate this absolutely critical communication system.
So we've journeyed through this dense paper, unpacking this fascinating molecular language these layered code cells use with chemokines and receptors, from the basic handshake to these intricate, flexible, SLIM passwords.
We've seen how understanding it gives us deep insights into basic biology.
And opens doors for potentially designing really targeted therapies down the line. It really highlights the elegant complexity of biology.
It truly does.
So thinking about all this, what other ways might understanding these intricate molecular conversations let us intervene in disease? Or maybe even program totally new biological functions? Something to ponder.
Absolutely. Lots to think about.
This episode is based on an open access article under the Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License. CC BY 4.0. You'll find the DOI and a link to the license in the episode description.